Florida International University Radcliffe Art and Design Incubator podcast, Tech Conversations. In this episode, I'm excited to welcome in someone who has gone out into space and spent, you know, a good amount of time there and is having this amazing conversation with us. I want to welcome in Winston E. Scott, retired U.S. Navy captain and former NASA astronaut. Welcome, Mr. Winston E. Scott. Thank you for giving me the privilege to interview you here on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Maggie. It's very good being with you. I'm looking forward to our interview.
Thank you so much. So, you know, I guess the first question with someone of your background and credentials is, you know, as a little boy, right, you were kind of born and raised in Miami. You're a Miami native, right? You attended Coral Gables High School.
Yes.
Did you sit in the backyard? Did you look out your window at the stars and the sky and say, hey, you know what? I want to go out into space. Let's start there with your journey.
Actually, I did not. When I was a kid growing up in Miami, the space program was interesting to me. We talked about it in school, like all elementary school children did. I read magazines about it. I watched space movies on television, but I never thought I could do it. I mean, it was certainly interesting, like all little kids, like airplanes and spaceships and aliens and so on. But it never occurred to me that it would one day become a reality. So I did not grow up longing to go into space, only dreaming about it the way most kids do. It wasn't until later in life that I thought it could become a reality, you know, during college, after college, and so on.
Yeah, because, you know, even as a little girl myself, you know, I would stare at the stars, you know, not that the stars were more available back then than they are today.
Seems like it.
And I looked up at the sky and always wondered, you know, what was beyond, you know, the clouds and the stars and the sun and when the moon was big and bright. But, you know, I myself never imagined being an astronaut either. Yeah. You know, I became a media communicator. But talk a little bit about your training. Like, what leads you to become involved with NASA and an astronaut?
Well, my training came through the Navy. And of course, a lot of NASA astronauts are military by background. Mm-hmm. All of the pilots come from the military, either the Air Force or the Navy, although all the military services are represented. The scientists, of course, don't have to come from the military, but quite a few do have military backgrounds. So I was a naval aviator. When I finished college, I entered Naval Aviation Officer Candidate School and became a Navy pilot. And I flew airplanes for the Navy for several years, went to graduate school, finished a master's degree in engineering, flew some more for the Navy, then got into the research, development, testing, evaluation side of flying. And then I was selected by NASA for astronaut training. And of course, I spent 7 years as an active astronaut and flew 2 space shuttle missions on Endeavour and then Columbia. And I'm assuming we're going to get into that here at some point.
Yeah, My
Navy training is what prepared me for the space program.
Let's make the transition right here. You know, you have this training, you're selected to be in the program. So you go on 2 shuttle missions, start with the first and then the second. And, you know, I quite honestly, you know, I haven't met, you know, anybody in my lifetime that has gone on both shuttles. So, you know, for me, it's a privilege to listen to the story. And I hope the listeners will also treasure this because you are sort of you're a hero, an American hero. And, you know, thank you for your service and thank you for, you know, kind of giving us that insight into, you know, outside of our earth. You know, talk a little bit about that experience.
Well, thank you very much. And yes, I do have experience on 2 shuttles. I flew for 9 days on Endeavour. Endeavour was the newest of the space shuttles. Then I flew for 16 days on Columbia, which was the oldest. So I got to fly on the newest and the oldest. My Endeavour flight was in January of 1996. And we had many different tasks to perform, many different experiments, but primarily I was the flight engineer for the flying parts of the flight. I was part of the flight deck crew, the 3 people that actually operate the vehicle. But my main job was spacewalking. The technical term is EVA or extravehicular activity. But what it essentially means, I put the spacesuit on and went outside. And one of the really interesting things I got to do on that flight was on that spacewalk, I tested improvements to the spacesuit itself. See, in those days, NASA was preparing to build the International Space Station. And I think the listeners all know that we have a space station up there. I've been up there for 20 years now. But when I was active, we were preparing to build the space station. And part of the preparation was modifications to the spacesuit to handle the extreme cold temperatures at which the station was going to be built. So during my spacewalk, I got to test the spacesuit improvements to be sure that they would keep the operator warm enough to wear out in space and build the International Space Station. Now, my second flight was on Columbia, and it was November through December of 1997. In fact, we were in space during a Thanksgiving holiday of 1997. We have Thanksgiving coming up right now soon, so that's going to be the anniversary of my Columbia flight. But anyway, I was a flight engineer again on that mission, so that means I was part of the flight deck crew, but I was still a spacewalker. I got to do two spacewalks on that flight. We tested all kinds of tools, equipment, again, for building the International Space Station. We launched a robot. It looked like a soccer ball, but it has stereoscopic television cameras for eyes. We tested that robot as a visual inspection device in space. We tested cranes. We tested improvements to the suit. One of the really interesting things that occurred on that flight was a satellite that malfunctioned. This was a 3,000-pound solar observation satellite that malfunctioned in space. And in order to retrieve it, my buddy and I manually captured that satellite during one of our spacewalks. So that was a really interesting phenomenon. But flying in space, as you can imagine, is incredible experience and so many different aspects to it. And I just thoroughly enjoyed it.
So let me ask you the million-dollar question, because, you know, so much has been said about going into space. And of course, you know, you didn't actually go in and step inside, you know, at the on the moon or anything like that.
Right.
But people are going to ask this question, and I have to ask it as a journalist as well. You know, is there life outside of Earth? You know, what can you tell us that you won't spill the beans on any international secrets, having, you know, been out there and kind of seen a glimpse outside of Earth that, you know, few of us, you know, will never be able to see, right?
Yes, that's right. But and actually, you know, we are really sort of playing around in our own backyard when it comes to space thus far. The furthest people have been, of course, is to the moon and back. Well, that's really very, very close. And we know that there's no life like us. There's no advanced life in our solar system. Now, I'm a person that believes in the odds. And when you consider the fact that billions and billions and billions of planets out in the universe, I find it hard to believe that our Earth would be the only one with life on it. So I happen to believe that there's life someplace out in the universe, and at some point in the future, we will probably be gone. But at some point in the future, people from Earth will encounter life from other planets, and then hopefully it's a peaceful encounter when that happens. But I can truthfully tell you, I did not see any aliens when I was in orbit, nor did I see any unusual phenomena. Everything we saw could be explained.
You know, that's so funny because, you know, so much has been talked about, you know, that mission of the astronauts, you know, landing on the moon and saying that it was fake. Even my 15-year-old a couple years ago said that it was a fake picture because the flag looked like it was moving, and he said that there was no air on the moon. So, you know, you have to take things with a grain of salt, right? But let's kind of fast forward. You wanted to say something, Winston?
I was going to say, yeah, you know, people make assumptions. Like your 15-year-old looked at the picture and assume that the flag was moving. The flag wasn't moving. The flag just wrinkled. It had been folded up. It was wrinkled. And the reason it was standing out is because it has
creases, yeah.
That's right. And they mounted the flag on this pole with the stemming to hold it up. And the flag was wrinkled because it just had been folded up. There's no air on the... So it's interesting how we can look at photographs and kind of make assumptions about things. But I can tell you this, the moon landing was not fake. I didn't go to the moon, but I have been in space, and I have talked to a lot of the astronauts, the Apollo astronauts who did land on the moon, and I have no doubt about it, they went, and we will be returning again soon.
Well, hopefully. I know that there's plans to do that. I think very soon, if I'm not mistaken, maybe in the next 2 years, is it, or 3 years, they're supposed to make it back?
Actually, Project Artemis is on track for next year, 2024. It's when we're supposed to put people on the moon again. Now, we'll see if that schedule holds, but Artemis is still on track. And of course, we've sent men to the moon before, but the Artemis crew, the first one that goes, will have the first woman. So we'll have the first woman on the moon here. And again, it's scheduled for next year, 2024.
Yeah, we,
I said,
you know,
I'm
we're
sorry.
grateful.
Listen, this is what we're in 21. So 3 years from now.
3 years,
I'm way off. So 21, we have 3 years to go. But 2024 is the time.
We are grateful.
The first test flight will be done next year. And then put people on the moon in 24. So let me correct that.
Okay. So we are grateful to NASA, you know, because we've spoken to them a couple of times here with the students working on different projects. And we did speak at one point at the with the communications director on Artemis. I believe it was about 2 years ago, just before, you know, this whole COVID pandemic yes. outbreak madness started. Yeah. Uh-huh. So let's move on from the shuttles and the spacewalk. And I want to get your take on what we've seen recently with the technology, because the way that you were traveling to the International Space Station was on the shuttles. We all saw the images of the shuttle opening and everything that was going on. But now the technology has changed. NASA has partnered with an outside company. I believe it's a SpaceX, right? With Elon Musk.
SpaceX,
and we see a whole different technology, right? We see the capsule leaving, and then it almost feels like it's on cruise control, and it just lands, you know, it kind of clutches in, it connects, and it kind of knows that it's on this flight for hours of hours of hours. So could you talk about the difference of that? Because, you know, I still question myself when I see the astronauts coming back and the capsule still landing in the water and the amount of time it takes for them to get out and how they have to, you know, kind of be in that capsule. I personally would have a panic attack. I'm not good for astronaut training.
Well, you don't have much room. You don't have very much room in those vehicles. That's for sure. It's close in there. But what has actually happened is the commercial companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and some of the others, they've actually taken NASA technology and they've tailored it. They've tailored it down for their specific mission. And by doing that, they've made it less expensive to send people to orbit. So they didn't develop this technology, but they took it and they commercialized it, and they've done a great job of doing that. What SpaceX does, for example, is send people back and forth to the International Space Station, and they also are beginning to send people up on tourist flights, the same as Blue Origin and Jeff Bezos and those folks. So they've taken NASA technology, they've upgraded, they've streamlined it, and they make it very, very, very cost efficient. Remember, these companies don't have to do what NASA did. They don't have to take large components to the International Space Station. They don't have to do research. They don't do spacewalks. They take people, tourists up, and they bring tourists back. Or they take astronauts up and take astronauts back. So they're able to take that technology and tailor it to a specific purpose. And then they can use the latest and greatest of engineering feats to make it affordable and cost effective. And what they're doing is tremendous. I love it. And I'm very supportive of these commercial private companies.
So I guess my next question, kind of leading apart from that, you know, kind of leading into that, is the recent kind of space tourism, if you want to call it, that we've seen with Branson wanting to go first and then Bezos going into space, you know, Virgin and then Blue Origin. And, you know, I think Bezos is now on his second. He took William Shatner.
Yes, yes.
To the edge of space, you know, who would have thought that, right?
Who would
After
have thought?
Watching
That's
Star
right.
Trek for so many seasons.
Yes.
So how did you feel about that when you saw that happening? And did they go to the edge of space? Because people are still questioning, where is that line where you actually cross and you're there?
Well, absolutely. I think what they did was great. And I think it was a really good move to send William Shatner into space. Apparently, he thoroughly enjoyed his trip. It was a life-changing event for him. But who best to send than Captain Kirk himself? So I think it was really, really good what they've done. You know, different organizations sort of define the boundary of space at different levels. NASA uses 50 miles. Anything above 50 miles is considered space by NASA. So that's my definition of space. But regardless, Blue Origin's flight, it was a SpaceX, and then Virgin, that they both have gone past this 50-mile mark. So officially, their people went to space. Now, they went on the edge of space. There were suborbital flights, okay, for the audience that doesn't know. They did not orbit there. They went up just above that line, that boundary, 50-mile line, and then they turned around and came right back down again. So officially, they have been to space. Now, what we're going to see, of course, is these private companies begin to send people on longer and longer missions. We will see them eventually put civilian space stations in space. We will eventually see hotels, and we will see tourist destinations. We will also see civilian research facilities in space. It's going to all just continue to blossom and expand. And as it does so, the cost will come down, and therefore it expands. Expansion makes the cost come down. Cost makes it expand, expand, and so on. And then we have really great access to space for many, many people.
So I want to ask you about the Mars mission, because, you know, us civilians here, you know, that are enthusiasts by space, we talk a lot and we say, you know, for a long time, we didn't see people going out to the space station. It almost seems like the space program has been on hold, which is quite unfortunate, because if you remember the Jetsons, by now cars should be flying. And I think we chatted about that. I'm still waiting for my landing pad at my house to fly my car. But you told me that's coming, right?
Absolutely. You know, it is a little bit sad that we haven't made more progress than we have. Our space program didn't actually stop. Our astronauts for a long time were actually flying back and forth to the International Space Station with the Russians. But now we're back on track and launching our own astronauts again. After the Apollo program, we sort of scaled back. We didn't continue to push. Had we done that, had we continued to expand out into space, we'd be on Mars by now. But be that as it may, we're on track. We're launching from here, the United States again, and Russians are still launching. They're our partners in space. China, separate, is also launching. We're not partnering with China, but they are. So again, the program is expanding and growing.
So
I answered the whole question. There's some more to it. You asked me something else that maybe.
Yeah, I wanted to talk too about the Mars mission, because we are in season two of the podcast, which you are headlining as well. But we had in season one. We kicked off our podcast. Our headlining guest was Andrew Johnson, who is an engineer at NASA, and he was in charge of some of the technical aspects of the design of the rover that landed in February and is sending back some incredible images.
Yes.
It's looking for ancient, you know, traces of ancient life. And then we sort of ended the podcast with a Hispanic, Elio Murillo, who was responsible for waking up the helicopter. And, you know, we talk about Mars. And you mentioned in some of your conversation on this podcast that we will be going there, hopefully, right? We should be sending missions there. So what is your take on the rover? I know that there's also, China also sent a rover. So there's a couple of rovers in Mars.
Actually, the U.S. has had several successful missions to Mars. The latest one you talk about with the helicopter is just that. It's the latest one. And of course, it's going along real, real well. That rover, like previous ones, has an array of sensors on it by which it can sample the Martian atmosphere, sample the soil, sample the landscape. This particular rover has a microphone on it, so we can actually hear what it sounds like on Mars. But what you will particularly hear is the Martian wind that's blowing. So it's a very successful mission going on really, really very well. The exciting part, though, is that after we land people on the moon, we begin working on sending people off to Mars. The target for sending people off to Mars, of course, is out in the 2030s. Now, whether we make that target or not remains to be seen. We're doing things one at a time as Artemis, put people back on the moon, and then put people on Mars for a permanent human colony. So yes, Mars is very exciting from the unmanned standpoint and also from the human standpoint.
You know, I love listening to that, because somebody told me the other day, what about if Mars is inhabited and they're just landing like on a side of, like, you know, the Antarctica here, that there's nothing, but there's a whole civilization on the other side and the little rovers are all on that. What do you answer to people that say that?
That's highly unlikely. If Mars was inhabited by intelligent life, we would know it, because we would have picked up, for example, maybe radio signals, other communication signals, electromagnetic signals, a radar or whatever. There's something that intelligent life emits that we would have picked up by now. So we're pretty sure that there's no advanced life on Mars. What we don't know for sure, sometimes I wonder whether there's advanced life on Earth, but don't know for sure is whether or not there was ancient microbial life on Earth. were there microbes alive? I'm sorry, not on Mars, on Earth, on Mars.
On Mars, yeah.
That's right. At one point in history, was there microbial life on Mars? And that's what we seek to find now. And that's why we're sending the rovers to Mars. Absolutely.
So, you know, I think you kind of answered my question. You know, we're aiming in 2024 to go back on the moon, right?
Yes, yes.
And then we eventually, after that, the timeline, we don't know what it's going to be. We plan to maybe send people, you know, manned missions to Mars. So that's what the future looks like in your view, Winston?
Absolutely. That's a logical approach. It's a good approach. That's what the future looks like. And I sure hope we hold to that. Hold to that means that the government continues to push towards those goals and actually make them happen. Yes.
So what do you tell, you know, these future NASA trainees, because there's they get younger by the day.
Yes.
I just recently saw a documentary on a couple of young minds that are out in Cape Canaveral training already.
Yes.
Part of different programs, getting ready to be astronauts. You know, mm-hmm. what advice would you give them given your track record?
Well, I give them the advice that they should continue to pursue their goals, continue to prepare, because the opportunities are going to continue to expand. I also tell them that access to space is going to grow, that NASA in the future, and we see it, we're on the cusp of it right now, NASA is not the only avenue to space, nor will NASA be the only avenue to the moon or to Mars in the future. NASA is going to be eventually only one way to get to space, to the moon and Mars. There are going to be other ways with other countries and also with private commercial companies. It's all going to continue to grow. So I tell them, continue to prepare yourself, to train, to study, to learn, but also be open-minded and broad-minded, because other new opportunities are coming.
So Winston Scott, thank you so much for joining the podcast. It definitely has been an enlightening conversation. You know, I live with the hope that, you know, somewhere, somehow there is life somewhere. I agree with you. You know, we can't be the only ones, right? Especially with all the skeptics and the rumors, yeah, and the conspiracy theories, right?
Yes,
that exist out there. There definitely is some kind of other life. And I hope it is, because it is kind of the hope and the future of Absolutely. Extending this civilization. So any parting words before we sign off on the podcast?
The only parting words is that we're doing some exciting things in space, and the future is even more exciting. So we'd like to see a lot more of our young men and women prepare for space, not just as astronauts, but as engineers and scientists and dietitians and journalists and historians. It's going to open up, and there are opportunities for everybody. It's so exciting. So we want to see a lot of young kids prepare themselves and get involved in the space program.
Thank you so much, Winston Scott, for joining our podcast.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
and for all your service and your contributions, you know, to everything. Thank you so much.
Thank you.